Okay, we bring the meeting of the Public Safety Crime Prevention and Policy Committee to an order. Do we have minutes?
Yes.
And we'll, I think we'll just note the roll instead of call it today.
Okay.
And then we'll bring, how about a motion to approve the minutes for April 14th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Rosenthal moves the minutes for April 14th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, first and only thing on our agenda today is Senate File 498. Come to us from the Civil Law Committee, and we are going to refer it to the General Register. So I'll move Senate File 498 referred to the General Register. And I have a couple amendments to get it in the shape the author would like. And the first one is the A3 amendment in your packet, 498A3. And what this does is just make some technical changes. And it is this the one that gets rid of the audit? Why don't we, well, anyway, what we usually do is bring them, vote on them, and then discuss them. So all in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
A3 is passed. Bring the A4 amendment.
Opposed?
What's that?
Opposed? You can ask opposed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. All opposed?
Nay.
All right. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Hertaus. And the, now the A4 amendment, author's amendment, A4 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Forgot how this is done in such a short time after we quit. All right, now. We'll go from here. We had to run through it. This is, for those of you who don't know, this is the body camera bill that we've been waiting for. And Representative Scott and I and others worked on it and brought a form through that we could pass through the Civil Law Committee. And now we've brought it here. And I'm going to have Mr. Gehring run through the bill here for us before we start testimony. Any questions yet?
Oh, Mr. Chair, while he's getting ready, members, I just wanted the folks that are here listening to know that last night in the Civil Law Committee, there was a lot of questions that were raised about whether or not a peace officer who was the subject of, who was in the video, could delete themselves out as a subject. And we worked on an amendment to make it very clear that a police officer cannot redact himself from the video unless they're, you know, an undercover police officer that's already prescribed under law. But we wanted, there was clearly confusion about that last night, and I worked with Representative Cornish today to make certain that everyone understands that a police officer will not be able to delete themselves from the body camera video as the subject.
And then I think we got rid of the state auditor's audit and made it our internal audit, right? Okay, we require the audit, but the department administration doesn't review it. And we got rid of the fiscal cost that way. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Matt Gehring from the House Research Department. We'll just walk quickly through Senate File 498, the first on official engrossment, which you should have in your packets. In addition, you should have a bill summary that in the overview section has some highlights of the key principles of the items that are contained in this bill. So Section 1 is a section that requires that the public arrest record resulting from any incident that law enforcement engages in include public information about whether a portable recording system was used as part of the arrest or citation. Section 2 relates to incident reports that law enforcement creates that don't result in an arrest or citation. So these would be, for example, situations where law enforcement is called to provide service at a medical emergency or something else like that. This similarly requires that the agency to document publicly whether they used a portable recording system as part of the agency's response to that incident. Section 3, starting on page 3, allows law enforcement agencies to withhold public access to video and audio records, in addition to the current law, which allows withholding photographs, which are part of inactive investigative files, if that data is clearly offensive to common sensibilities. This section, given the way that the data is classified for portable recording systems later in this bill, this section primarily is going to cover inactive data that an agency receives from an external source. So, for example, if a witness or someone sends in a cell phone video or a photograph that they took on their own and provided it to law enforcement, if that video or picture would be offensive to common sensibilities, this would allow the agency to withhold public access to that data. Section 4, the public benefit data section at the bottom of page 3, allows law enforcement agencies to release private or non-public portable recording system data if doing so would aid the law enforcement process, promote public safety, or dispel widespread rumor or unrest. And then Section 5, starting on page 4, is the real sort of substantive section of the portable recording systems data practices section. Subdivision 1, lines 4.4 through 4.9 provide that this section would apply to agencies that maintain portable recording systems, and then also provides a definition of what a portable recording system means. Generally speaking, these are body cameras, but might include other devices as well. Subdivision 2, starting on line 4.10, provides the data classification for portable recording system data. Generally speaking, the data is going to be private or non-public data. There are two key exceptions to this. One is that data which documented peace officers' use of force that results in substantial bodily harm will be public. And then secondly, data that a data subject requests be made public would also be released and available to the public. If a request is made by a data subject, other data subjects that are in that same video who do not consent to the release of the data would be redacted from that video. On line 4.18 to 4.21, there's similar language to an earlier section. This allows the agency to withhold access to portable recording system data if it's clearly offensive to common sensibilities. And then there are some, additionally, some sort of miscellaneous exceptions to disclosure if the data will be public because it's personnel data or if it's classified by other provisions of Chapter 13. Paragraph C on line 4.30 allows a person to bring an action in district court in the county where the portable recording system data is maintained to authorize disclosure if it's otherwise classified under the section. And in that court action, the court will be required to balance the public interest in disclosing the data to that person with the potential harm to the law enforcement agency or to data subjects that are in the data. Subdivision 3 on page 5 provides the retention schedule for these data. Portable recording system data that are related to an active or inactive criminal investigation are required to be maintained for the longer of either 180 days after the investigation becomes inactive or the statute of limitations period for the crime that was being investigated. And if portable recording system data that don't relate to an active or inactive criminal investigation would be maintained for at least 90 days, but not more than 12 months. Subdivision 4, starting in line 5.14, provides provides some clarifications related to data subjects. Paragraph A specifies that peace officers who are recorded in the data are included as data subjects, and so they would have the rights that are provided by Chapter 13 to data subjects to access that data. Paragraph B provides that that data subjects are required to be provided access to the data to the full extent required by Chapter 13, as long as the data is maintained. This language was modified by the A3 amendment that was just adopted to specify that while peace officers do have their Chapter 13 data subject rights, they don't have the right to request that their identity or activities be redacted if the data is released to another individual. Paragraph C, starting on line 5.25, allows peace officers involved in investigation to review portable recording system data prior to completing their final written report or formal statement on the investigation or response. Subdivision 5, starting on 5.30, requires law enforcement agencies to maintain an inventory of portable recording system technology, and there's a number of items that need to be maintained in the inventory, including the total number of devices maintained and a record of the amount of data that's collected. On page 6, subdivision 6 requires on-duty officers to only use the portable recording system that is issued and maintained by the officer's agencies, by the officer's agency in documenting the officer's activities. And then subdivision 7 provides some substantive requirements related to authorization to access data. This is language that is identical currently to what was enacted last year related to automated license plate reader data. So agencies are required to have written procedures to ensure that personnel have access only if they're authorized in writing to do so, and that it's be that the request for access be based on a legitimate specified law enforcement purpose, and also based on a reasonable suspicion that the data are pertinent to an active criminal investigation. Paragraph C, starting on 6.21, requires the agency also to maintain what are called audit trails, so you can verify who's accessing pieces of data and for what purpose. Subdivision 8, starting on 6.28, governs sharing among different law enforcement agencies, so if one agency collects the data and is going to provide it to another agency, effectively what this requires is that both agencies have to comply with the requirements for access that are provided in Subdivision 7. Subdivision 9, starting on 7.4, requires agencies to maintain some records that can be audited. They're required to arrange for independent audits once every 2 years to determine whether the agency is complying with this section of law and other appropriate or other applicable data practices law, and also to verify that the data are being used appropriately and are being destroyed appropriately. This language that's in the bill right now is language that directs that the Commissioner of Administration has some authorization to issue orders for suspension. The amendment, the A4 and A3 amendment that were just adopted, removes that power from the Commissioner of Administration and instead puts it on the local governing body with jurisdiction over the agency to make those orders. And then finally, Subdivision 7, the penalties for violation. These are enhanced penalties in the case of a willful violation by an agency. Currently, the Data Practices Act allows for exemplary damages for willful violations of between $1,000 and $15,000 per violation. This would double those penalties. So in the case of a willful violation by an agency related to portable recording system data, the agency would be liable for between $2,000 and $30,000 per violation. And then Section 6 provides some procedures related to adoption of portable recording systems within an agency and the policies that go with it. First, an agency is required to provide an opportunity for public comment before it purchases or implements a system, and the public comment must be received both in writing or it can be received at, or an opportunity must be provided at a regularly scheduled meeting of the governing body with jurisdiction over the agency. And then Subdivision 3 requires that agencies adopt written policies and procedures related to use of the portable recording system, and there's a number of items listed in paragraph B that must be contained in that policy. And then lastly, Section 7 requires that the legislative auditor conduct a comprehensive review of compliance with the portable recording system law beginning January 1st, 2019, and requires a report to the legislature by January 15th, 2020. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of the bill.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Gearing. If it's okay with you folks, we bring the Chief Schnell up and just wants to do an introductory and then start questions then.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Clarification.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gearing, on line 4.17, it says release must be redacted if practicable. Could you explain that to me, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, this actually might be a good question for Chief Schnell to answer because it has to do with the technology. I know some agencies do have software that allows them to sort of automatically redact images, and some agencies, I think, don't have that. So what this is saying is that if the agency is able to redact someone's image, they're required to do so, but it doesn't mandate it if it's not possible for them, given the technology that they have.
Okay, Chief Schnell? Give an introductory about the bill, and then we'll go with questions and testifiers. Chief, now go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. We appreciate to be here. My name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Maplewood, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Law Enforcement Coalition. The coalition is made up of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. My comments will be very, very brief and just would be open to any questions that you would have. But collectively, we represent more than 10,000 police officers, law enforcement officers across the state in communities both large and small. We are in support of the bill and are appreciative of the chair and all the members who helped get this in the form it is today. And I think even the amendment that was just offered to the committee is a reflection of the fact that we desire to kind of make sure that there is clarity about this going forward for everyone's sake. As a coalition, we do believe that this bill addresses three important issues around body cameras, and that is personal privacy, the privacy of people who call upon us for services. There's an increase in accountability for officers, and those people who have encounters with officers can obtain and access that data. And it does provide for higher levels of public transparency, even in the fact that we are able to hold officers accountable and address issues when it's brought to our attention. So we believe that this bill reflects that. We know that it has been a long time coming and much effort by many people sitting around this table and throughout both the House and the Senate, and we're appreciative of all that. And we believe that over the course of time, we tried to mix the bill to come up with the best solution, and we believe that that's reflected here. With that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions that committee members may have.
Members, question of the bill or Chief Schnell? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for being here, Chief Schnell. So I'm looking at Subdivision 2 about the data classification for court-authorized disclosure, and it speaks to the issue of data becoming public when the use of force results in substantial bodily harm as defined in Section 609.02, Subdivision 7A, and any data that a subject of the data request be made accessible to the public, provided that the data on the subject who is not a peace officer who does not consent to the release must be deducted if practical. So I'm going to go out there and say, so there's an event where an officer shoots somebody and they're dead. They don't have an opportunity, and according to this, you can't get consent of a dead person, so that person would be redacted. Am I reading this correctly?
Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, I believe that there is provisions in the law around other family members or legal representatives being able to address that, so that there can be, and there would be automatically in cases of substantial bodily harm, that information would be, in fact, public under the bill.
You're looking at the bill or the amendments? I think the amendment address. Yeah,
To
that point?
Mr. Chair, to that point, I think, and I'm not trying to insinuate the direction that you're thinking, but actually the direction at substantial bodily harm and above makes it public. So in what you just stated, or the point that you made, Representative Dean, I believe what I heard you say, in the instance of a fatality, that would automatically make it above the threshold, and it would be public, so groups or others would be able to get that. Anything below substantial bodily harm would be subject to the person who would be alive, and would... they would then have the authority to be the people or person who would have to get it. But it's at substantially bodily harm, which is in state statute definition noted in 609, then it's public data.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Okay, Chief Schnell, thank you. And then we'll bring up our first testifier, Irene Kale. Pronounce that right? No? I should remember from last night, but go ahead with your name and title and organization.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Irene Gao. You wouldn't know it from looking at it. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Council at the League of Minnesota Cities. And on behalf of over 830 cities, we support this bill. We have been working with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and the Law Enforcement Coalition on this really important issue. And at this time, it is really important that a bill on body cams gets passed. As you can see from the letter in your packets, at least 27 cities are waiting for the state legislature to act before they even consider implementing body cameras. And even in my conversations with cities that have implemented body cameras, they're still looking for state guidance because of this very complicated issue. Now, some people might say that this issue is only about transparency, but that really discounts the complex nature of body cameras and this issue. In addition to transparency, we have to consider other important issues that Chief Schnell also talked about in terms of privacy and responsible government functioning. Body cameras present a unique technological shift that highlights concerns of people's privacy. And currently, while there are situations where body camera data is private, such as active criminal investigative data, most of it is public. For example, a body camera that might capture valuables if an officer goes into a home where it's not an active criminal investigation, that would be public. Or another example, where a parent comes up to an officer who is looking for assistance regarding a mental health issue with a child, that would also be public. Now, I can't think of any good public policy reason why that type of data would be public. Opponents might say that cities are actually just concerned because this is expensive, because of the costs related to body cameras. The fact of the matter is that for cities to act responsibly, they have to be concerned about costs. And given the state of the law right now, given the fact that body cameras are mostly public, there's increased costs related to data storage and staff time. Regarding transparency, the bill has many places where the data is actually public. And it actually starts, that the public is involved and has a right to know. And it actually starts right away from the first get-go in the bill. It provides that the public has an opportunity to provide comment before cities even implement body cameras or adopt public policies. There are also several instances within the bill where the public has access and it is classified as public data. In fact, there are seven. In inactive criminal investigative situations, such as the use of force situation with substantial bodily harm, that would be public. That's the first one. The second one is if the subject, and the subject does have a right to make the data public and accessible to the public, that's the second. The third that was mentioned by Mr. Gehring is that if there's a final disposition in employee discipline under personnel data, that's public as well. The fourth one is biennial audit. As you can see in the bill, there are a lot of requirements in there. That's public as well. And the law enforcement agencies have three instances where they can also make the data public. If it will aid in law enforcement process, promote public safety, or dispel widespread rumor or unrest. And as you can also see in the bill, in addition to these seven situations, someone could also ask a court to disclose private or non-public data. With the author's amendment, and as Representative Hillstrom had pointed out before, there is an effort to make sure that there is transparency, and if there are concerns that have been brought up by the public yesterday, that there are folks who, from law enforcement and cities, have been trying to address it. The bill as it is right now, I do believe, balances the three important things: transparency, people's privacy, and responsible city functioning. I want to thank the author and the committee for hearing this bill and stand for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Gao. So I'm concerned this bill is very specific about a few things, and then it leaves a lot of other things up to the policies and procedures of each city, which means we're going to have a few things that every city has to have, and then we're going to have a lot of things that city are going to choose to have or choose not to have. For instance, if an officer does not turn on his camera or her camera and there's a complaint filed against that officer, each jurisdiction is going to decide how to handle that, whether it's presumptive that the officer actually committed the misconduct and has to prove their innocence, or there's no recourse at all. So we're going to have a lot of different types of situations throughout. And I guess my question to you would be, would it make more sense for us to be more prescriptive on what cities do, or would it make more sense to actually be less prescriptive and speak primarily just to the issue of privacy and just to the issue of storage?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a tough balance because there are a number of considerations, and as we've talked about before, it is tricky when we're talking about privacy, transparency, and how cities govern. And the compromise really is that there are a list, as you can see, what should be in the written policies, and those are the important points. But at the same time, it's important for cities to have that discretion to decide what works best for them. The small departments to the large departments, it may be different. And so I think that there's some guidance from the state, but cities still should be able to do what they see best fits them.
Okay, any other questions? If not, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And a gentleman from the St. Paul NAACP. You, Seth?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, sir, and take the stand and give us your name and organization and begin. Before you begin, sir, how many other people that didn't sign up want to testify? Anybody in here? We just got you, sir, and then one other gentleman back there. So, okay.
I'm going to switch chairs if that's okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to fall out of that one.
What's the matter? Can't hear anything.
Yeah.
You can get if you want.
Good afternoon. My name is Yusef. It's Y-U-S-E-F. My last name is M. Janney. M as in Mary, G as in George, E as in Edward, N as in Nancy, I. I am the first vice president of the St. Paul chapter of the NAACP. I am the second vice president of the Minnesota-Dakota Area Conference, the state chapter of the NAACP, and I am also the political action chair for the Minnesota-Dakota Area Conference. I'm speaking today on behalf of the St. Paul NAACP, Jeffrey Martin, president, the Minnesota-Dakota Area Conference, William C. Jordan, Jr. is the state NAACP president, the St. Paul Interdenominational Black Ministerial Alliance, which is a coalition of 36 African American and multicultural congregations in the city of St. Paul. Pastor Charles Gill, Pilgrim Baptist Church, is the president of that organization. And the African American Leadership Council, which is a coalition of more than 36 community-based organizations, executive directors, elected and appointed officials, and Tyrone Terrell is the chair of the African American Leadership Council. Before I offer my official remarks, I'd like to point out that the St. Paul NAACP was among those civil rights and community-based organizations calling for body camera legislation, both at the state level and local policies that were mutually beneficial for the law enforcement community as well as for citizens. And I appreciate the opportunity for public input from the public rather than having others testify on the public's behalf. In fact, the St. Paul chapter of the NAACP wrote a letter of support for the St. Paul Police Department to the Department of Justice for a $500,000 application which they submitted for body cameras for a pilot program in the city of St. Paul. And we have been engaged in very candid and productive mutually beneficial conversations with the St. Paul Police Department last year and continuing this year, and we intend to do so throughout the implementation of their body camera. And although there are many parts of this bill that we do not support, we would hope that it would not restrict the progress that we have made and increase the mistrust which exists between law enforcement and many low-income communities because of unfortunate incidents, misconduct, officer-involved killings, or other incidents that have been captured on cell phone video over the past couple of years. These incidents are not new. The cell phone videos are new in the fact that they have been captured and broadcast around the world. Many recent incidents of law enforcement misconduct, misinformation, officer-involved killings of unarmed young men of color across our nation that would have gone unnoticed had they not been caught on cell phone videos have created what Vice President Joe Biden calls a breach of trust between law enforcement and communities of color in America. It is out of this breach that these communities and civil rights organizations have called for mutually beneficial officer-worn body cameras and mutually beneficial legislative and local policies concerning their use and deployment. Mobile cameras operated by law enforcement could play a valuable role in the present and future of policing, whether they are worn by an officer or mounted on police equipment. Cameras could help provide accountability, transparency, and greater public trust in law enforcement practices by providing firsthand evidence of public interactions. And we believe that there is not only a cost, but a significant savings in other areas if implemented correctly and in a mutually beneficial fashion. But police-operated cameras themselves are no substitute for broader reforms in criminal justice and policing practices. Cameras could be used to intensify disproportionate surveillance and enforcement in heavily policed communities of color and low-income communities. Without carefully crafted policy safeguards in place, there is a real risk that these new devices could become instruments of injustice rather than tools for accountability. Our concerns fall under the five broad policy areas of recording, retention, access, use, and technology. To help ensure that police-operated cameras are used to enhance civil rights, legislation and department policies must do the following. One, develop camera policies in public with the broadest possible input of civil rights advocate and the local community. Current policies must always be publicly available, and any policy changes must also be made in consultation with the community that made the original request for their responsible deployment and utilization. Two, commit to a set of narrow and well-defined purposes for which cameras and their footage may be used. In particular, facial recognition and other biometric surveillance technologies must be carefully limited and restricted. If they are used together with body cameras, officers will have far greater visibility into heavily policed communities where cameras will be abundant than into other communities where cameras will be rare. Such technologies could amplify existing disparities in law enforcement practices across communities, as could the bill before you. Three, legislation and local policies must specify clear operational policies for recording the retention of tapes of at least 1 year and access and enforce strict disciplinary protocols for policy violations. While some types of law enforcement interactions, such as when attending to victims of domestic abuse or medical incidents, may happen off camera, the vast majority of interactions with the public, including all that involve the use of force or harassment because sexual, racial, homophobic, xenophobic harassment is just as vicious as substantial or demonstrable bodily harm and ought to be public information when requested. And these things should be captured on video. Departments must also adopt systems to monitor and audit access to recorded footage and secure footage against unauthorized access and tampering. Purely from an accountability standpoint, the ideal policies for body-worn cameras would be for continuous recording throughout a police officer's shift, eliminating any possibility that any officer could evade the recording of abuses committed on duty. There is also the danger that the technology could be misused by police supervisors against whistleblowers or community or union activists, for example, by scrutinizing video records to find minor personnel violations or departmental policies to use against an officer. If the cameras do not record continuously, that would place them under officer control, which allows them to be manipulated by some officers, undermining their core purpose of detecting police misconduct and promoting greater accountability. Four, make footage available to promote accountability with appropriate privacy safeguards in place. At a minimum, footage that captures police use of force or other forms of harassment or misconduct should be made available to the public and the press upon request. And two, upon request, footage should be made available in a timely manner to any filmed subject seeking to file a complaint, to criminal defendants, and to the next of kin of anyone whose death or injury is related to events captured on video. Departments must consider individual privacy concerns before making footage available to broad audiences, and consider footage, audio, or video of victims private in most instances. In theory, police or other government officials might need access to videos of potential abuse by an officer in their own efforts to monitor and hold efforts to accountable. The Minnesota Human Rights Statute allows citizens up to 1 year to file a human rights complaint. If local departments have the discretion to destroy video and audio recordings from body-operated cameras within 3 days, 10 days, 15 days, that information will no longer be available to promote accountability or to help citizens press their case. We should further not rely on citizens to make the determination about when tapes should be deleted, and we should not rely on those abused by police to be the sole lever of accountability. The legislature should also surely not take that position in order to avoid the possibility of coercion. Providing someone involved in a police matter the power to unilaterally destroy a video prevents the police and other government agencies from monitoring and disciplining problem officers and bad behavior. Five, policies should preserve the independent evidentiary value of officer reports by prohibiting officers from viewing footage before filing their reports. Footage of an event presents a partial and sometimes misleading perspective of how events unfold. Pre-report viewing is not only preferential treatment of law enforcement officers, but could cause an officer to conform their written or recorded report to what the video appears to show, rather than what the officer's motivation was or what their immediate recollection of what they actually saw or did. I would be happy to provide a copy of this testimony to the committee page and to stand for any questions that committee members or staff might have.
Any questions? Representative Schoen was first, then Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if I say it wrong. Mr. Mangani.
M. Janey,
I apologize.
No problem.
So, Mr. M. Janey, I mean, on your timeline, I'm not disagreeing with the year personally, but, you know, the 90 days is a compromise between many parties who wanted zero. In the data privacy world, so that's been a problem. Outside, there's maybe a couple things that would be difficult. One thing I do know is that an operation of a body camera for an entire shift is just, it's unfeasible at this point, simply because the battery won't last, the storage requirements are immensely expensive, and that's been part of our discussion as well, too. And I also think that I might have the deserve the privacy to go to the bathroom unmonitored, just like anybody else as well, right?
I've heard that remark, and I support it wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I bet, and so, Mr. Chair, I want to say you went through quite a few things, and there are things in there that I absolutely agree with, and I do respect the work that has been done in the East Metro between the St. Paul NAACP and the St. Paul Police Department. And so I'm curious on that, because over the years there's been a lot of great work in the East Metro between the communities. What here in this legislation prevents you from continuing that work with Commander Henry and the St. Paul Police Department to develop the policies that the St. Paul Police Department would be best served
with the St. Paul community.
Were I in a position to do so, I would ask that question of you. Okay? In terms of time, if I'm arrested and put in jail for 181 days and then get out and solicit counsel or family members encourage me to file a complaint, what good does it do me if the video is no longer available? Okay, as
well,
I said,
that Mr. Chair, now once it's part of an investigation, it's evidence. It's kept.
Is it automatically an investigation if the subject of the video is incarcerated?
It would be in my department and in any other department.
Would that be up to the departments to determine, the local departments?
Well, Mr. Chair, the policies and guidelines come, you know, we have standard policies and guidelines that are set forth even from the Post Board and other agencies' model policy. But my question to you is, what do you see within that need in this state law that's going to prevent you from working with St. Paul Police Department to develop what the community of St. Paul needs? I mean, the 90-day issue, that's here, that's solid. I don't think that, I mean, they can't keep it longer, and I don't know how we're going to get past having more time for you on that one through all the competing concerns about data privacy and the idea of surveillance, which you also cited, and that's why those folks. So I'm just curious about the other things that are here. Is there anything left specifically that, not in everything that you said, but that prevents you from working with St. Paul to set up specific guidelines for your community in St. Paul?
Representative Cornish, Representative Schoen, you've asked a number of questions yourself. Let me respond to them in the order in which they were raised. Low-income communities are not necessarily skillful in navigating the criminal justice or law enforcement system, okay? And if local communities have the option of creating a very short time frame during which these recordings are kept, and I'll get to the cost factor in a minute, then they may not make the decision within a very narrow time frame to file a complaint, in which case the evidentiary material would be helpful either in exonerating the police officer or in upholding the complaint of the citizen. Again, we're looking for mutual benefit, to protect law enforcement officers and to protect the public. And as I stated in my testimony, the Minnesota Human Rights Statute allows for a one-year period to file a human rights complaint. An officer may make a sexist remark to my daughter during the course of a traffic stop, and if she should not decide for 91 days that she wants to take actions and feel that the comments were inappropriate, if it's captured on body camera and it's deleted, then it's her word against his, and it goes nowhere. Okay, so we think that the data should be held for a statutory length of time commensurate with Minnesota law, not here today and gone tomorrow. In terms of storage, the costs for storing data on cloud servers or on local file servers is going down every month. And when you look at the drop in the number of complaints that are filed for incidents that have been captured on body-worn cameras, the savings to the departments far outweigh the human and financial cost associated with having to secure legal counsel, whether it's through the local municipality or private on the part of the law enforcement officer, to defend themselves for a complaint filed against them. And it's been stated in front of this and other committees that 95% of the time when an incident is recorded on a body camera, the subject of the recording does not wish to file a complaint, and in 95% of those cases where the 5% left where a person does, the officer is exonerated. So I think you'd avoid a lot of out-of-court settlements. You'd avoid a lot of unnecessary expenditure of resources by the police department, by the municipality, by the time on the part of the officer having to go to court, fill out amendments to their initial report, and so on and so forth. So I think there needs to be a balance there in terms of cost versus benefits, okay? In terms of a full shift, the pilot projects that have been undertaken around the country have demonstrated an excessive absence of body cameras being turned on when they should have been, okay? Officers have not been compliant in terms of following their own departmental policies of when body-worn cameras should be turned on. When the officer has full and complete control, no strict guidelines and significant disciplinary penalties for not fulfilling them, the officers sometimes 60%, 70%, 80%, and the research is on the internet for anybody who wants to look at Los Angeles, San Antonio, countless other cities around the country, where officers either did not or forgot or claimed the equipment was faulty, where there was no recording of incidents that turned out to be very controversial and involved lengthy time and lawsuits and increased mistrust between the community and the police department. So while I'm not suggesting that I'm interested in your bathroom visits, I do think that there ought to be very clear and strict procedures so that body cameras are on when they should be and where there is even the inkling of a possibility that they may produce evidentiary evidence that will exonerate a police officer, hold them accountable for inappropriate behavior, or uphold a complaint filed by a citizen. I don't think that's unreasonable, and I don't think this bill provides that. In terms of what's in this bill, I stated that giving officers the right to review the audio and video prior to filling out their reports is preferential treatment for law enforcement. Do people who are arrested have the right to view the report before they answer questions from the police when they're asked to make a statement? Are they going to be taken into an audio-video studio and allowed to view the report before they make a statement to the police? Do they have to hire a lawyer if they can afford one or have a relative find one and come down and publicly make the request and identify the officer and go through the whole procedure before they're allowed to look at a video, which the law does provide, but at some point, not immediately? So we're saying mutually beneficial. If the person who is arrested or is charged does not enjoy that right, the officer should not enjoy it. And the officer, the first recollection is often the most accurate and most important, should record that without looking at the video, in our opinion, because they will enjoy the right to amend their report if there is an investigation, if there is pretrial consultation, or they are preparing to testify. They would then enjoy the right to go in, look at that video, amend their report, and include any information that they may have forgotten. To allow them to do it automatically, again, raises the danger that they might craft the report to only what the video shows or supports, rather than what may have been included in an initial report based on their memory, which is what they do today. So that's a problem. The time frame is a problem. The access only to the public for substantial bodily harm or demonstrable bodily harm eliminates a lot of misconduct, which has led to the mistrust that exists. And you know, the substantial bodily harm is a significantly high threshold. People in communities just want a level playing field. You know, they want public servants to serve the public, and they want to be held accountable. We want community members held accountable, and they want law enforcement members held accountable. And I don't know if you've had the amendment yet for Section 9 under what local policies must include, requiring local police departments to include anything from the Chief of Police Association or the Law Enforcement Association is an unfair burden. And again, we would like not to restrict the progress that we've made and the opportunity that we have to work together to build trust. We've had more officer-involved killings in the city of St. Paul than any other city in the state of Minnesota. So the fact that we are working with, have endorsed, and support the St. Paul Police Department's use of body-worn cameras, and the fact that we're engaged in an ongoing, mutually beneficial dialogue with them ought to be evidence that we're doing something right, okay? In view of the high number of officer-involved killings. And I'd like to think that we don't have officers named Thumper for obvious reasons, and we don't have the kind of adversarial relationship that many law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota suffer from in relationship to their communities. I hope that responds to your questions, and as I indicated, I'll provide my testimony and you can see the specific areas where we have concerns. I don't want to take any more of your time than necessary. Thank you for your question.
Yeah. Before Representative Constantine, we really can't wait anymore. I mean, we've got 10 times the number of cities. We've got 10 times the number of cities that want us to pass something as the ones that want us to wait. And knowing all the problems that you've got to work out yet in some of these cities, we try to attack the main points. It's kind of like the handgun permit law when you preempted cities from doing certain things. It was main things we wanted to be a standard mandated policy so everybody would be the same in certain ones. And then we did leave a lot of details to work out, you know, for the administrators, like when they actually do turn the camera on it, when they get out of the car, when they start their shift, or things like that. So we just saw a lot of people waiting for this thing, and we can't wait another year with all the money that some of them invested in.
Representative Cornish, I've heard that concern, and the representative from the League of Cities indicated that 23 of the 803 cities that are members are waiting for guidance from the legislature and will not implement body-worn cameras. I think if the other 780 are prepared to go ahead with their communities, that we could flesh these concerns out. We're reluctant to do it a day late and a dollar short at the tail end of the session when there are so many obvious disagreements between us. But I do understand and respect and appreciate your perspective.
Yes, sir, I don't think we'll ever will agree. We've got people on our own caucus and our own committee that don't agree on everything, but we thought after a while we just got to go for it because we're going to take two more years here of disagreeing and working out fine points. So at some point you got to, pardon a pun, pull the trigger.
I appreciate that, but I think you've gone for it in the dark, and we're being asked to come and react and respond to it at the 11th hour, and I don't know that that's going to produce mutually beneficial public policy.
Okay, we did have an informational meeting where you were at and you testified time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, Representative Hillstrom and Representative Dean.
So I just wanted
Considine. Oh, I've got you on this list. Representative Considine, Hillstrom, and Dean, and Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the gentleman answered my question. I just quick yes or no, though, to make sure. You want every single piece of video kept for a year?
At least a year, yes, sir.
Oh, that's actually the one thing I have a problem with, because I don't feel like people that haven't done anything wrong should have their videos kept more than a couple of weeks. I got the perspective that you gave with your daughter. Interesting. I'll have to reconsider that, but that's I struggle with having retention too long rather than the other way around.
Representative Cornish, Representative Considine, I appreciate your perspective and I understand it. What you're in effect doing, however, is requiring people to make a life-changing decision within a two-week period that could cost them considerable financial resources, which they might have to marshal even in order to secure legal counsel and put a complaint forward. They would have to navigate a very complex system. They'd have to overcome any potential fear of retaliation, and they might not be prepared or emotionally ready to do that at the drop of a hat. So I think we need to give the public the benefit of the doubt, and we need to give the officers the added protection of having that evidentiary material in the event that a complaint does come up within that statutory period. And to say that we're going to protect your local police officers only for a period of 3 days, 10 days, or 2 weeks, and then they're on their own because there is no more record is not fair to them or to the public. So we just ask that it be mutually beneficial and allow for the protection of both parties.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. So I've struggled with this issue a little bit because I, too, believe that retention is really important, especially when there's statute of limitations issues. So I was looking at the language of the proposal, and I'm going to ask some questions of some others about those statute of limitations and how long video is supposed to be retained. So I appreciate your comments. So one of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit about was in your testimony, you talked about whether or not the person who was arrested would actually get a copy of the CD.
Would have an opportunity to view it before they made their statement.
Correct.
To law enforcement.
Correct. And they would, based on the language of this bill. So if they were, a defendant doesn't ever have to give a voluntary statement to law enforcement, but this bill would allow someone to say, I want to review the data that I'm in the camera. I want to review it first before I give a statement, and they would have the opportunity to view it. They couldn't make it public because there's still the investigation going on, but they would have the opportunity to view it under the language of the bill.
Would they be informed of that as part of their Miranda rights?
They would not.
Okay, so it would be up to the individual either to educate themselves, up to organizations like ours to educate them, or for them to realize and understand in a very emotional, distraught situation with their hands handcuffed behind their back that they have the right to request to view the video before they make a statement.
They do. So I just want to make sure, I just wanted you to know that the language is in here that they would have the right to do that. Whether they knew of that right or not is a different question, but they would have the right to do that. The second thing is when you're arrested, if you're arrested as part of a criminal investigation and you go and spend that time in jail, as part of the discovery of a crime, you and your lawyer are entitled to all of that information.
I'm aware of
that.
And
they would have to be given a copy of that CD-ROM. Now, if you were arrested as part of a different case, you know, you had a warrant for your arrest on something else, you wouldn't necessarily be having that data saved as part of another criminal investigation.
Now, if an officer pulls you over, gives you a traffic stop, and makes an inappropriate sexual remark, would they have the right to that data, too?
So you would have the right to review any data that you are the subject of. So if you're in the video, you get to review it until they delete it based on the retention. Now, again, I am a proponent of longer retention periods. I think my view didn't win in this. How long you get to keep the piece? So I think that's important for both sides, right? For how long you want to wait to file a complaint, as well as the statute of limitations on criminal activity. So I think that's really important. So I just want you to know that we are hearing you and that we do appreciate that the work that you're doing. And I think there's a lot of complicated issues that are going around in this particular proposal. So I appreciate it, but I want you to know that someone who is arrested, who is the subject of the video, has the ability to view that video both before they give a statement and if they're charged as part of the criminal activity.
I'm well aware. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dean, and then Representative
Representative Dean, is it okay? You already asked the question once. If we could let Zerwas go ahead.
Oh, no, I'll defer.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Mr. M. Jenny, I have a question because you talked about a lot of things, and you talked about the policies and the operational policies that will be implemented by different jurisdictions. And when I read in the bill in, I believe, Section 6, Subdivision 2, about public comment, I look at this and I think about all the times in different places I've seen public comment, and nothing comes of that public comment. I had the good fortune or the misfortune to participate in three of the public comment sessions in the city of Minneapolis and watch what the recommendation of the Police Conduct Oversight Commission was to the city in regards to the draft policy that were proposed. And quite frankly, I was really abhorrently disappointed in that none of those recommendations, none of those comments, none of the concerns of the community made it at all into the draft policy. So my question to you is this something that is even important to be in the bill?
Is what important?
The comment period, because it seems that many jurisdictions will just sort of do it as a formality, and that will be where it ends.
Well, one, Representative Cornish, Representative Dean, I'm hopeful that my appearance here tonight won't be a disappointment when I go home and this bill passes. I'm a firm believer that the best public policies are the most well-informed, and I am not of the opinion that this is the most well-informed public policy. I'm part of an organization called St. Paul Strong, which is promoting greater transparency and accountability in the city government in St. Paul, because many policies are implemented without broad public discussion and disclosure. And we, the NAACP, the African American Leadership Council, the St. Paul Interdenominational Black Ministerial Alliance, would be remiss if we did not share our concerns with you, even though we may be casting pearls before law enforcement. Okay? And I tried at the very outset to stress that we are partners and supporters of our local police department. We're not flag burning, traffic blocking, marathon stopping protesters. We are the nation's oldest, boldest, largest civil rights organization. St. Paul NAACP is 103 years old this year, and we will continue at the local, at the state, and the national level to continue to speak out against policies that we feel have a detrimental impact on low-income persons and persons of color. I think citizen engagement is one of the highest responsibilities within a democracy, and only hope that I've never learned how to be brief, so I talk fast, that my powers of persuasion don't fall on deaf ears, because these are the concerns of the people who requested body camera legislation, not the concerns of the police department, although they share many of them. These are the concerns of mothers, of people who attended funerals, of people who want to work with, to respect, and to trust the police department. So we're asking for your help in doing that, not for increasing what Joe Biden calls the breach of trust that currently exists. It pains me that the St. Paul Police Department suffers from incidents that occurred in Ferguson, in New York, in Cleveland, in Florida, and in other places around the country, because the media portrays the police as this huge monolithic mob. And we want our police department to look like our community, to be sensitive to our community, for police officers to live in our community, to know police officers on a first-name basis, and to respect and trust and support them. And body camera legislation could go a long way to either help or defer that. And I'm pleading with you for the latter, not for we got to do it, people are waiting, it's the 11th hour, we're going to rush it through, we hear you, but we've already made up our minds. So do with me as you will, and bless the information that I give you by the use you put it to, because this will be the real test of how mutually beneficial whatever you do is. And not just in the black community, please. I'm not here speaking on my own for our children and grandchildren, but what it does in your own communities, as some of your members have testified before you, have experienced. So public comment won't occur automatically if it's not in there. And it may be cursory or tertiary or trivial, but we will have to continue to have faith in the St. Paul Police Department and St. Paul City Government and continue our dialogue.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be a little brief. I guess my main comment, the testifier, and thank you again for coming in today, sir. I know you were in last evening too, and I appreciate your commitment to the discussion. The testifier raised concerns about the high bar at substantial bodily injury for the video to become public, but that is, as the testifier from the League of Minnesota Cities said, that is one trigger for the video to become public. Quite honestly, if you're a subject in the video and you feel as though you were mistreated by law enforcement and that something occurred that did not raise to that bar, there's nothing in this language that would stop that would stop a subject of the video to request that video and then make that video available to the media, to put it on YouTube, to do whatever you needed to do with that video in the furtherance of your complaint, if you feel as though that is a serious enough issue, but it does not trigger the automatic release. So I think there's a little bit of difference in how we talk about this, because at one point with this substantial bodily harm or greater, it automatically becomes public data. However, a subject of the video could release that in the future, even if it didn't raise to that level. And so I think that's an important thing to talk about.
Representative Cornish, Representative Zerwas, thank you very much for your statement. I thought there might be a question in there between the lines. We receive about 95 voicemails a week. We're a volunteer organization. And half of those people are either uneducated or fearful of retaliation, either on their job or from law enforcement, higher education, whoever they have a complaint against. And they believe that we should do it on their behalf. We should drop everything and right away address their grievance. And many people are going to be unwilling to submit themselves to any kind of public identification or scrutiny or the fact that they've raised a complaint for fear that there may be repercussions if they're the only person of color or woman in management or working for their company or on the job, or if they have had a less than positive experience with a member of law enforcement here or somewhere else that they've been in the United States. And we frequently make those requests, which is why it's important for us to have an ongoing good relationship with the St. Paul and East Metro Police Departments. And I don't know that that's going to change with the passage of this legislation. So, but it's a reality. That's why we're here, because people have asked us to be here.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you for allowing the opportunity.
Next, we have the gentleman coming down here. I would like you to pronounce your own name so I don't pronounce it like it was last night. Yes? You want that copied and given out? Could we get that accomplished, Paige? Thank you.
Over there, sir. Right there. He's waiting for you right over there.
Representative Sherman.
Go ahead and give your name and your organization, or if you're representing yourself.
When I was 18 years old, there was a woman who asked my friend, who was her son and I, to come on down to the state legislature and testify. So I'm going to begin in an atypical way. In the beginning, there was the impetus to be more than what had become. And patience, while not negating, reminded us that we must walk and never run. For even though the sun seems to be setting, she too will rise again. And so in her absence, we build an edifice perseverance can be proud of. This is the meaning of a priori, as in the beginning there is the impetus to be more than what it become. Now, who it is that I represent, and actually what it is that I represent, is I am the only white Latino from Long Lake, Minnesota in 1990, according to the census data. The median income in the area that I grew up in, I believe, is over $100,000. And I'm here to talk to you about the assumptions that white people are able to make every single day, and the detriment that my existence is because of that. I'm not speaking for any other people of color, I'm speaking for my experiences. And I'm talking about how the leeway and the wiggle room of this bill, it's pushed me to the...
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I don't think he said his name for the record.
Canon a priori.
There we go.
Canon a priori. My apologies.
Thank you.
By all means. And to be completely honest, and I took care of some other business earlier today, but tomorrow I'm going to go get my passport. What's happening here is very, very scary. The leeway and the wiggle room that is allowed, I think we're starting from the wrong place. I understand that there's pressure to get this bill on out there. I think that we're protecting the wrong people. We're protecting the police officers. It is the job of the police officers to protect the constituents. And just in the manner of how society is progressing, open data is the appropriate investment. We need conversations. If we would like to speak on an economic level, I think that we're maintaining ourselves with what would be called a solo growth model. And we're solely looking at human labor and capital. We have not moved yet on to the Romer model, which is going to include human intelligence. And that's where we're talking about the intelligence, the human capital, the human intelligence of these police officers to be able to deal with increasingly diversified conversations. And so right now, while we go through that struggle, we're allowing for this data to be maintained as private. And I'm curious as to somebody can view the data, but they, when can they take it with them and make that public? Is that after the investigation, or you can't do that during an investigation? Because that is a concern of mine, is when can this video be made public, and even when it is, how many redactions are there going to be? I don't think we're servicing the conversations that our community needs, and I think in a lot of respects, concerning what it is the other gentleman said, I think that this legislative body is hamstringing those who are at the forefront of these conversations. They are difficult. They are very, very difficult. But we need to have time and the evidence that this data can provide. They are difficult conversations. Not everybody's going to look wonderful. As far as for me and my experience, when I was 15 years old, I went to a football game at my high school. And I was walking on in, there was a young lady that was standing there, and she had a lanyard hanging out of her pocket. I wiggled on that lanyard. I spent about 3 hours a day with her, every single day when I was in high school, and I just wanted to say hi. I got about 25 yards on down, and there was a police officer who told me, "Don't harass the women." I was one of 5 people of color in my high school graduating class. I was the only one who was non-Asian. I'm very, very sorry, but there is an issue of cultural miscommunication in this country and in this state. And within the police conversation, it's very easy for that disparity in conversation to lead to the loss of lives. Now, with regards to Jamar Clark, didn't he have a complaint filed against the police officers about a month and a half before his life was taken from him? See, the thing that why am I getting my passport? Because that's my life. And it's as I've said elsewhere, after 32 years of existing within this state, I understand that you don't care about me. I understand that you use your words. I've seen as Representative Cheryl Havash, she went to the church that I went to, 2-3 days out of the week, every single year I grew up, Jim Ramstead. I've known people that have sat in your positions, sat in other positions. I've seen a lot, folks. That's why I came here today, and I look like crap, because I don't care. I know that you don't care. My life doesn't matter. Our lives don't matter. I have friends that live in Mankato. I don't go to Mankato anymore because it's racist. Why would I put myself in that position? It's the same reason I don't go to Duluth. If one go to Hutchinson, I'm going to make sure that I know who's coming with me. And who's coming with me is on NPR right now. And who's on NPR right now, I'm going to go talk about the people that actually put this bill forward. And we're going to talk about how these racial disparities affect the future that we want to build for our families, because this disproportionately affects our children. And I'm not looking at what happens a year from now or 2 years from now. I'm looking at what happens 3 to 5 years from now when this policy is well implemented and we're building off of it, and that's why I think it's the wrong starting point. It's a lot easier to close down doors than to open them up when they've already been locked tight. And just as far as the... And as I do get back to the economic economic issue of this, there are other people who are very vocal about the racial disparities in this state, and it is having an effect on who immigrates here and why. As somebody who has experienced the dominant culture in this state, all the way up from Kitson County in District 1 to Winona, I've experienced everything in this state, and it is horrifying. It's incredibly, I can't begin to tell you. I have a friend of mine that I met, my first friend of color I met when I was 25. And I was talking to him about some things, and I said, you know, my uncle's a bully. He said he went to a school. And I said, oh, what school did he go to? He says he goes to this school. And I said, do you know this person? He says, yeah, I do know this person. They bullied my sister. Oh, that's funny. It's my cousin. And I see exactly how there is a psychology to this. And I've had friends who served tours in Iraq and came back to work with other police officers up in Minneapolis. There is a psychology. And it's about healing our communities. But the police are not the ones that need to be protected. It is the constituents that need to be protected. And it scares me because at day's end, I understand that it's the money in y'all's pockets that are causing you to say the things and do the things that are being done. And it's people's lives that are being lost because of that. And there's a tragic history of that in this country. And that is... I'm sad that I can't wait to leave, and I'm sad for who it is that I leave here. What it is the state has done, and the continued errant steps that you are making with all of your justifications, I know all of it. I got friends that got their JDs. I grew up with all the smart people. I can read your laws. I understand. And it's about the assumptions that we're able to make. And then what happens with those assumptions and whether we're actually being encouraged to step back and reevaluate. I encourage you to read the book Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. How does our editorial process work? How do we encourage the editorial process of our peace officers? When they enter a situation, they get a call from somebody, and yes, they're coming to serve somebody, but is the person who made that call, are they being entirely truthful and accurate about the situation that's being walked on into, or do the police officers think that they're walking into a situation and they're ready to be aggressive? Instead of, I was a couple weeks ago and we were talking about Jamar Clark. I asked a police officer over in Minneapolis, do you go through any cultural training? He didn't have an answer for me. He mumbled somewhat of a yes, and then he said, hey, LT, do we go through cultural training? So the moral of the story is that whatever cultural training they are going through, it's not having an effect. This is a tragic disparity that even our mental health, even our Department of Health in Minnesota says, racial disparities, racial equities, it's a mental health issue. This is affecting everything. This is the new conversation, because it's, as I said yesterday, these houses were built to sanction the murder of people like me. And at some point in time, I see the assimilation process that is necessary for people such as myself to actually be, quote, listened to by people such as you. And I have practiced this with CEOs who make millions of dollars a month in their business. I see this. I've seen this. So I know nothing's going to change. And blessed for the day that I can get on that plane and not have to come back. But the least that I can do for what it is that I have done here is to let you know that the problem is real, the problem is horrifying, the problem is not going to affect you, it's going to affect your children. And that is why, to a degree, I said what I said yesterday. Do we have the maturity to make the appropriate decisions and to be vulnerable instead of protecting those who are already protected and privileged because they don't want to be vulnerable when they are already asking to serve the public as servants? Blessed and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, sir, for coming down. Chief Schnell, could you come back? And I think the Representative Hillstrom might want to ask you a couple questions.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I really want to talk a little bit about the retention data, because ultimately that is one of the issues we hear about quite recurringly. And I understand that there's been some negotiations about how long it should be retained. So I'm trying to get a sense of the real timing. So when the portable, I'm looking on line 5.7, the retention of the data. So the portable recording system data that relates to an active or inactive criminal investigation must be retained for no longer than any applicable statute of limitations period has expired, or 180 days after the investigation becomes inactive, whichever is later. So we have some pretty famous cases in Minnesota where children have gone missing, or we just had a murder in Ramsey County that was a cold case for a really long time. And so I'm trying to get a sense of, you know, when is it that a case like that would become inactive? Or once a case is a cold case, what's it classified as? And then is that information then mandated to be deleted? Or is that information going to be kept? Can you explain to me how some of those might work?
Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think there are certain classifications of data, certain cases that have significantly long retention periods. For instance, a homicide case in our case is a permanent file. That is maintained forever, and so that it is that retention period would be the period that we would maintain those types of data on those cases. But the case does at some point in time become an inactive case. However, because of the nature of that case, another example might be sexual assault cases may be held as some sexual assault cases would be held as permanent files from our retention period, and in those cases, this data could be maintained because it may have critical importance, and it's especially in cold case situations at some point along the way. And frequently, we have reports about these, and those reports are there. And because of the statute of limitations on many of these crimes, can be in some instances forever. Where you can come back and charge those cases later on, that's where I think it varies. But when we look at in our city, and I think there's actually some guidance in certain cases where the statute of limitation is established, I believe by statute, but I know certainly by policy, we classify our retention of these cases that are of significant consequence with considerably long retention periods.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so I'm thinking of, you know, you have a teenager who goes missing, right? And you don't know if it's an abduction or a runaway, or you don't know if there's a crime. I'm trying to figure out what the retention period for something like that might be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we would, in a case like that, in a missing, as long as that missing person is entered and they're in that system, that does remain active in that sense. Certainly, there's going to come a time when we may run out of leads to work and those sorts of things. So it may not have the level of kind of effort that's being put to it simply because we don't have things to work. But the fact is that once that child would be placed in the system, or that vulnerable person would be placed in the system, that gets maintained until that person is recovered, and that case is essentially able to be reopen. In many cases, the term that often is used to describe this is the case becomes pended. It is in a pending kind of status because it's ongoing, but we don't have things that make it able to be worked. And I think this is frequently the status in these cases that can become cold cases, missing persons, homicides, some sexual assault cases can fall into that classification.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's also, you know, not criminal matters that you might get some video about, and we've taken some testimony about interactions that someone might have concern about. And I have heard interactions from both sides, right? There was an interaction that didn't go very well, and they want, one side or the other wants the video retained. Do you foresee a procedure or a process by which either party could say, even if something hasn't been filed, that they could say, I want you to save that data, I don't want that data deleted because I may need to access that in the future, right? I mean, I think law enforcement, someone can make an allegation against them for a couple years, right? And I think that, as we heard the testimony, someone could file a human rights claim a year later. So is there a mechanism to kind of protect that data from deletion if there's a 180-day deletion procedure?
Thank
you. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think, we routinely right now get requests on a regular basis to retain data, because, and that could be for a whole host of reasons. Somebody may call and say, I would like you to retain all emails, as a for instance, pertaining to X, Y, or Z, or all data related to a given circumstance, and we comply with that. I do think that in this particular case, I think certainly these would be policy things that we should work out. Just listening to the testifiers, I think that there is good merit in having some discussion about these policies. I think I can say in my community, I will imagine that there will be a quite a robust conversation about what that should look like. And I think the 90 up to a year retention was in an effort to try to find a way to meet a host or a range of needs. Some people that feel that the 90 is too long, and others may feel that the 1 year is highly excessive. So I think ultimately, I think there is a place where in policy and through this engagement process with our elected bodies in our cities or our counties, these things should become matters of some public discussion and debate.
One final question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Reverend Gilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the language, we hear that any person who is a subject, right, in the video can get a copy, and that you know, other people have to be redacted out if they don't consent to being released. So I'm a prosecutor in my day job, right? And one of the things that I always want to make sure is that the defendant has the right to a fair trial. And I do have a little bit of worry if someone else is in the video, right? Not the defendant, but someone else is in the video, and they're part of the subject of the video, and they get a copy of that video, and then they choose to release it to the public. And so you don't necessarily have protection of a defendant's rights, I would think, if someone else that's in the video could release a defendant's video. So if you could at least think about that. I know this bill's going to be moving forward. I know that folks are going to keep talking about it and they're going to keep working on it. But if you could think about that particular piece, because ultimately, there needs to be a way for the public to know, but there also needs to be an effort to make certain that at every step, a defendant's rights are protected to make sure they get a fair trial.
Mr. Chair, just really quickly, I would just say that in many of the cases that you described, some of that would be confidential data because it would be maintained as an active criminal case, and in that case it would be confidential other than subject to the release through disclosure or discovery processes. Which I think is the appropriate and very commonplace in most instances.
Okay, thank you, Chief. Any other questions for the Chief? If not, questions to the bill? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple of concerns. I've talked to law enforcement in the community that I represent, and you know, one of the big concerns that I have is that there's no dollars that are attached to this for data storage. We're asking law enforcement and cities to take on a pretty significant responsibility, and that feels a little irresponsible on our part to not provide the additional support for folks to be able to do that. So I would just say that. And when we talk about public comment, that looks different in each community. So as we're having cities inform what the policy looks like for their constituents, I think there's some cities that do that really well, and there's some cities that don't necessarily know how to do that outreach, hear from members of the community, and at least law enforcement, where I live, have expressed concerns that we're not sort of providing more guidance to what that looks like, and that, you know, in some ways, maybe passing some of our responsibilities on to the cities where we should be just more intentional about that. I understand the urgency for this. I mean, clearly many of us have heard about it. It just feels, I'm just a little disappointed that we weren't able to get a little bit further along in sort of fleshing this out a little bit more.
Okay, thank you, Representative Fleming. The we actually aren't asking them; they're asking us. So we thought if they're going to ask us, they need to come up with the money, and that's why we put the public hearing in there that they have to have. You know, they're going to have to consider that. And we probably suggest that if they didn't have the money to take the proper storage, that they stay out of the system. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, as we go forward and talk about this bill, I do intend to vote in the affirmative at this time. I understand this bill is an important issue, and we need to move it through this committee. However, I do have some deep concerns, and some there are some unresolved issues, in my opinion. And what my final vote on the floor will be dependent on how this bill moves forward. But I will be voting in the affirmative because I understand we need to move this forward. But again, I do have concerns about cloud storage, potential security issues with that. That seems to be unresolved at this time. I also echo the concerns that Representative Hillstrom had put forth here. She was reading my mind about what would happen to some of this data or some of these cases as if you know they get out onto Facebook or other social media outlets. That's always a big concern. But also, at the end of the day, members, I still have to yet see how this completely lines up with our Fourth Amendment rights. I still have to resolve as well. But I will be voting in the affirmative at this time. And where this bill will be, I hope it will be in a better place. And I'm withholding my judgment for my floor vote until it gets to the floor.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. And Chief Schnell hopefully can get together with you and another chief and maybe answer some of those questions about security, where it goes and how they take care of that data. And I don't know if it will allay all your needs or wonders, but hopefully it will. Representative, Lucero and then Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo the same concerns that Representative Neuberger just mentioned. And this would be a question for staff. If the language that's in this bill, if it has to be in adherence to the Criminal Justice Information Services security policy, which is published by the FBI, last year in our conversation regarding license plate readers, that document, it's published by the FBI and lists a baseline of security standards that departments must adhere to. So those technology systems that the license plate readers are related to have to adhere to this. However, my understanding is that that baseline document would not be in scope for the technology systems that body cams footage would be on. And if that's true, then I echo the concerns that Representative Dean had because you wouldn't have a baseline policy that all departments have to adhere to, but instead you'd have each department coming up with their own policy, standards, procedures, etc., for the protection of the data on those technology systems. And so when I read, let's see, it's lines 6.9 through 6.11, it references a law enforcement agency must comply with sections 13.05 subdivision 5 and 13.05. So I went to 13.05 subdivision 5 and it reads, establish appropriate security safeguards for all records containing data on individuals. That is extremely vague language. The definition of appropriate is in the eye of the beholder. So it just emphasizes the fact that we wouldn't have a baseline standard as we had last year. So then when I go to subdivision 9 of the bill, it reads the biennial audit, a law enforcement agency must maintain records, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we had an amendment that changed the biennial audit, the results of the audit. So the new language with the amendments that were adopted this evening, if the governing body with jurisdiction over the agency determines that as a result of the audit, they're not in compliance, then they themselves shall suspend the use of the portable recording systems, etc. So it's the city council, for example, the governing body over the local agency, that themselves, they're going to be self-policing. So first of all, they're going to come up with their own standards on a municipality-by-municipality basis, and then the audit of that's going to occur from a third party, but then the results of that audit are going to be reviewed by themselves, essentially. And so
that's what I have a great concern over, is because, as was mentioned, this is a Fourth Amendment issue, in my opinion. And we have the government going into the private homes of people and filming without their consent and then retaining that on systems that may not be protected adequately or sufficiently. And just, I'll finish, Mr. Chair, with just a few comments of some of the examples that are not addressed in the bill that would be addressed or were addressed in the minimum baseline standard document from the FBI. A user account management, password policies, password lockout, the encryption of data, when the data is in its storage, if it's being stored at rest or if it's being transmitted. The issue of personally owned equipment. Can you access this data that might be stored in cloud from a personal machine? Proactive monitoring. The bill doesn't reference attempts to do an end run around security controls, such as multiple failed login attempts, etc. Patch management. So you have operating systems and you have software that continuously must be updated. And if it doesn't get updated with necessary patches to fix vulnerabilities, it could be compromised. Anti-malware protection, vulnerability scanning, etc. Again, those are all issues, just some examples of issues that are addressed in that document that, because if after research gets back to us, if that document doesn't apply to these technology systems, should be a huge concern for most of us. Thank you.
Representative Schoen and well, Chief is coming down.
Well, he maybe might be able to help back me up on this, but any third part, Mr. Chair, and members, any third-party vendor that holds data for law enforcement or public safety has to be CJS compliant, which meets all your stuff. I mean, that's just standard, and this wouldn't be excluded from that for not saying that specifically in a three-page amendment to the bill. And so, I mean, we wouldn't be able to operate without it. So that being said, so if you have something to say to that, I'll have more, but I can stop and let you. So, okay. So we've solved that. But basically, I do agree. Representative Flanagan, our departments would love a little spiff to implement this stuff. But it is not a mandate, and I think that's what's important, is that departments are not mandated to implement body cams. We're not doing that. But we are opening the door here for a lot of departments and a lot of agencies and municipalities that are saying, we want to do this, but we will not do it until you put something forth. And it may not be a perfect version. We know that. We have all identified around this table things that we don't find to be our own perfect bill. Nothing in this legislature happens that way. Otherwise, we'd all be king. And that is part of a democracy. We all have to try to figure out how to work together. I'd like longer data storage. Some people want zero. But that is the way it works, and I appreciate that we are moving forward at this point. It took some encouragement to get us to this point, and I appreciate everybody continuing to work on that. What I did like, the gentleman from the St. Paul NAACP and Commander Henry, we talked real quick. You know, there's nothing in the bill that prevents those two organizations or any organizations from working together to continue the conversation around what the local agency should have, and also maybe being that conduit between the community and the police department to help either obtain videos or work on behalf of various communities to create a better sense of accountability. And I know many of us in law enforcement would appreciate those partners in doing so. So thank you all for hanging in there and continuing this conversation so that we can get this back on track.
Chief Schnell, did you want to say anything?
Okay. Yeah.
Representative Considine and then Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am going to support the bill based on what the things that you were talking about earlier. We need to get something in place to give law enforcement some guidelines, but I don't believe that this is done, and we will need to come back and revisit it. The only other thing was, is the gentleman from the NAACP, wow, I think he's really changed my mind about where I'm at. I don't recall a time when I've ever realized how much my position in life has colored my perception, and I need to reevaluate the idea of the length of time on the holding it. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Palm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and with the help of, what was alluded to by one of the testifiers, the savings from not having the frivolous lawsuits to where things become a fraction of a percent, I think would maybe one of the ways to offset, some storage cost, but frankly, just having the availability of seeing what the officer saw, because we all realize with everybody having a camera, the different viewpoints, while you rotate through the different viewpoints, and there's things you see and don't see, and I think there are good things to having the record of what the officer actually would have been able to see and not see. As to the data and the practices, etc., that was part of a component of an amendment to the amendment that Representative Schoen offered, and I offered that amendment to the amendment to show an example of some of the, other things that we could look at trying to include. But it would be nice if before it hits the floor, that if there's a BCA or statewide document or suggested policy procedure for data storage protection, that that be shared with at least the members here, if not most of the members, maybe in a soft copy, so we'd understand what is standard operating procedure for that, those databases that are out there now. Thank you.
Any other questions? I'll give you the last comment and we'll vote.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, just to answer a little bit of your question on that, this is evidence. It has to be treated as evidence. It's got to be secure.
Okay. Now the Chair will renew his motion for Senate File 498 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. Motion prevails. And thank you, and meeting adjourned.